Blog Talk Radio.
Cuts off like that. Anyway, that was Bojack Cornbread. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the segment Bringing Sexy Back. This is your host, Gail Delicious Johnson, and I have my co-hosts on the line. I'm going to bring them in. Good evening, Rhea and Jadino. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Good.
Good.
I'm good. I thought I got cut off again.
Oh. Yeah, so we have a we're going to have a good show this evening because that song Cornbread, our guest this evening is going to be Cornbread, the inspiration behind the movie Cornbread, Earl and Me, and he's one of Philadelphia's graffiti artists. His name is Daryl McCray, and he's referred to as Cornbread. He's a graffiti artist from Philadelphia, started in 1967. And he's regarded as the father of modern graffiti. He is also known for his writing his name on an elephant at the Philadelphia Zoo and on the side of the Jackson 5's private jet. His initial efforts in graffiti were based upon his love interest for a girl. McCray is currently a social worker. A documentary titled Cry of the City, Part 1, The Legend of Cornbread, was released in 2007. And we have Daryl McCray, Cornbread, on the line. I'm going to bring him in, and we're going to get this show on the road. Good evening. Would you rather I call you Daryl or Cornbread?
Either or, Daryl.
Oh, okay. Good evening, Daryl, and welcome to Delicious Talk. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm great.
Good.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Right.
And I must say I'm impressed with the theme song. Cornbread. I like that.
Oh, okay. I thought you would, yeah. And I like that artist, too, Bojack. He's no longer here, but I just love it, the Zydeco music that comes out of New Orleans. So, yeah, that's Bojack, very talented. Well, was a very talented artist, but he's no longer with us. So, tell us a little bit about, you know, your childhood. You know, do you have any siblings? And then we'll work around to how you got to become the father of modern graffiti.
I have two brothers. I'm the little child. I have a brother that's 11 months younger than I, and I have a brother that's 6 years older than I. I was born and raised in North Philadelphia, in the Brewery Town section of North Philadelphia. And I grew up in the tumultuous 1960s where the gangs controlled the streets. And growing up in North Florida during that time, it was not easy. The gangs controlled the streets. And if you wanted to get out of poverty, you normally went to college, played sports, or you're a musician. I didn't do neither or.
Mm-hmm.
People dream of getting out of college by going to college and becoming famous musicians or superstar athletes. But I had a different plan. I wanted to be known globally in the years to come. I have put my name into history. My name crossed the seven seas, the four corners of the planet. I was the youngest person ever to start an international art movement. I changed the historical course of my generation and gave birth to a global phenomenon.
Wow. Okay, so tell us, how did you get the name Cornbread?
Well, as a child, I was problematic with my parents. A lot of problems, you know. I did what I wanted to do, and that often involved me on the wrong side of the law. And I wound up being committed to a juvenile delinquent facility.
Excuse me, Cornbread. I'm hearing some background noise. Okay. All right, go on.
So while I was committed at this juvenile facility, we would go to the cafeteria to get our meals, and a lot of times when we went to the cafeteria, it was like a buffet.
Mm-hmm.
We got to the bread was always white bread, and it wasn't always fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And I just took it upon myself to go to the back of the kitchen and approach Mr. Swanson, who was the head chef, and I would suggest that he put some cornbread on the menu. And he would say, like, who gave you permission to come back in my kitchen? I said, nobody. So you just don't come back to my kitchen and make requests like that. You know, get your butt out of line. Get your back in line and do what's expected of you. So I would suggest to Mr. Swanson that he put some cornbread on the menu because my grandmother makes the best cornbread in the world. He said, we don't make no cornbread around here. Make it your butt back in line. And I left. The next day I was right back at Mr. Swanson's place again. And he said, you know, you're becoming a nuisance. We don't make no cornbread around here. Get your butt back in line and don't come back in my kitchen no more. I left again. A couple of days later, I'm back at Mr. Swanson's kitchen again. So this time when I came in, all the cooks seen me coming, and they hollered to Mr. Swanson, Mr. Swanson, your boy here. He was like, who's that? Cornbread. He said, oh, shoot, again, come here. I walked up to it, and I said, Mr. Swanson, can we talk? And he just gripped me up by my collar and started walking me out to the counter, out to the cafeteria where all my peers are at. And he kind of threw me, he said, keep this cornbread out of my kitchen, and kind of threw me. And all my friends started laughing at me, calling me cornbread, teasing me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mind them calling me cornbread. So when I got back to my unit, I wrote the word cornbread on the back of my shirt, and the whole institution called me cornbread. I was no longer being teased as how I was addressed.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when this took place?
I was 11.
11?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
And when I see the gangbanger names on the walls, I would write my name right next to their names, real big. And I had the respect of the gang members because my sister used to send me poetic books, you know,
mm-hmm.
to read, keep me in trouble. And I was marveled at the words that I read. I used to write the passages down. So when a gang member girlfriends would write them letters, they would let me read them, and I would respond to the letters for them using my poetic words that I got out of the books.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the girls who received it, it was kind of, you know, they was impressed with my writing. And they would write the letters back, and I would write it back. And the more I read, the more I wrote passages down. And I got a kind of reputation as a poetic love letter writer. And this is how I gained the respect for the gang members. So when I came home, I was invited to the gang members' neighborhood to come drink wine with them. And I wrote my name all in their turf. I wrote my name all throughout the entire institution. I wrote my name on the blackboards, in the school class, in the bathroom, the cafeteria, the visiting room, the administration building. My name was written all over Youth Development Center. When I came home, I had the whole institution talking about me. When I came home, I took that same concept to the street. In 1967, no one wrote on walls. There was no graffiti anywhere. I was the first graffiti artist who wrote his name on the walls solely for the purpose of establishing a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started writing graffiti, people thought I was a nut. They didn't understand. Teenagers didn't catch on to what I was doing until I started appearing in the newspapers. I walked the bus routes. I mean, everywhere I went, the subway stations, the L stations, I wrote my name everywhere. This is what I did to escape the pressures of the ghetto life. You know, guys, they drank wine, they gang warred, a lot of killing and stabbings and a lot of crime going on in the black man. I wasn't into that. I wasn't a graffiti writer. And when teenagers start saying my name, they say, like, who is this cornbread? Why is he doing this? I mean, what's up with dude? And when I started appearing in the newspapers, they said he made the newspapers because he was naming a wall. I can do that, and I can do better than that.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the wall writers start coming out the walls. I mean, they was like writing graffiti names on the walls everywhere. By 1969, the city of Philadelphia became the graffiti capital of the world.
Hmm.
And this went on, the graffiti in Philadelphia went on unchecked for 13 years. before Wilson Group came into office. And he came up with that Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network.
Well, let me ask you this. When you were writing, you know, all over the city, were there any repercussions? Were, you know, did the police ever approach you or, you know, just what was going on with that? And
well, back during that time, it wasn't against the law. It wasn't against the law until Wilson Good changed the law and he started making hardware stores and other stores you could purchase graffiti spray paint, spray paint.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be locked. You had to use that lock and key to purchase a can of spray paint. I mean, when you went to get a can of spray paint, it was under lock and key. The law was changed. Back then, it was not against the law to do graffiti.
To do the graffiti. So what made the law change? Because it became an eyesore.
It was just really bad. It was really terrible. The media really made a monster out of me because there was a guy named Cornelius who got killed. And when
mm-hmm.
Corn got killed, they mistaken my name. They thought it was Corn Brick got killed.
Mm-hmm.
When Corn's in the street, you know, his brain is thrown out and he was walking by. Corn is dead. Corn is shot. Somebody killed Corn.
Mm-hmm.
And when the media heard that it was Corn got killed, they assumed the Corn short for Cornelius was a Corn short for cornbread.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to see my death.
Wow.
And I'm going to work one day, and I'm reading about my death in the newspapers.
Wow.
And that was a prescription for disaster. I knew that I had to do something amazingly bizarre to snatch the public attention to let it know
mm-hmm.
that I still exist.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing, the real Cornbread is not dead. But it didn't
mm-hmm.
have any impact on the general public because they had just read in the newspapers, Cornbread is shot to death. That was the rumor that swept the street. So
right.
I knew that I had to do something because I refused to let Corn go to his grave with my reputation. And I had pondered countless possibilities. I eventually concluded to spray paint my name on a live elephant at the Philadelphia Zoo
mm-hmm.
to bring my back from the dead because I knew the media would cover it. And I went to the zoo, and I watched this elephant for 2 days. And I watched the zookeeper take the water hose and spray the elephant down. I watched the zookeeper take the rake and rake up his waste. The elephant had been in captivity for so many years, became domesticated tame.
Mm-hmm.
Human with to make physical contact with the elephant. I seen the zookeeper pat his trunk, you know, tug on his ears, you know, just make physical contact with this elephant. And I concluded that this man was not in danger, neither would mine. And that
mm-hmm.
third day, I went to, it was like 6:45 before the zoo opened. I walked to the back of the zoo, climbed over the fence, and came down to where the elephant was at its closure. And there was like a little small concrete wall. And I hopped over into the pit, and I took the top off the spray paint, and I started shaking at the can so they could hear the ball.
Mm-hmm.
The elephant turned, looked at me, and we made contact, and he presumed on what he was doing, didn't pay me any attention. And I walked
mm-hmm.
up to him, and I said, Cornbread lives. And I ran him
wow.
out to the other side. Cornbread lives. That was the beginning of a legend. That was the making of a legend.
Mm-hmm.
I got locked up coming out of the zoo because somebody must have seen me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm making my exit turnstile, and all these park bars pulled up, and they arrested me. When they took me out to the police station, he said, guess who we got in custody? We got Cornbread. And half that day, all the cops came to my cell. Which one of y'all is Cornbread? I said, here, kid, give me your autograph. I'm going to tell my wife who I met. And this went on all day. I went to court for it. The courtroom was like a circus. The administration
mm-hmm.
workers, the employees, everybody came to the courtroom. They was like, well, wishing me, want to shake my hand, want to autograph. And I'm like, wow. And I knew that that was the beginning of something big to happen.
Wow. So yeah. Once you, I'm sorry.
It didn't stop
Hello?
Here. When I seen how the response I got from the general public, I knew that all I had to do was wrap my name on bizarre things and not mm-hmm. receive attention from the media. I was a glut for publicity. I was an attention seeker. And mm-hmm. I heard Georgie Woods, and Georgie Woods is a radio DJ on WJAS. He announced on the radio that the Jackson 5 was coming to town to do a battle against the 5 stair steps.
Mm-hmm.
And he invited the general public to come to the International Airport. It's like a publicity stunt.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to come, get a photograph, come to the International Airport. And that was something of the norm when the Rolling Stones came to town, when the Beatles came to town, the public came and took pictures and got signed autographs, got to, you know, shake the musician's hands. It was like that. And
right.
It was the same with the Jackson 5. So I guess down there was about 80 people. And they announced the loud speaker that the panel would be landing. They can land in about 5 minutes. I had a spare plane with me. And the plane comes in, and it idles for about another 5 minutes. Finally, the steps let down. The steps let down. Michael Jackson. It wasn't Michael Jackson. It was called the Jackson 5. He came
mm-hmm.
to the top of the steps, kissed everybody. And it was just total chaos, screaming, hollering, hooper, and it was just out of order. You know,
mm-hmm.
going back then, the Jackson 5 was the hottest thing in America.
Mm-hmm.
When Jackie, Michael, Tito, Jermaine, and Marlon came down the steps, the entourage came down the steps, they walked through the crowd, everybody went berserk, everybody just screaming, hollering, and it was just total chaos. And in the midst of this chaos, I zipped up the steps, and write my name on the check. And now I was no more concerned about the Jackson 5 than the man on the moon. And
right.
I went back into the terminal, and I wanted to watch this plane take off with my name on it. You know, I was like a publicity freak. I loved to see my name in the newspapers. And I knew I had the way and the concept of getting attention. And I
mm-hmm.
sat in this terminal about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and finally the propellers on the airplane start spinning. I say, yes. And the plane backed up and went this way, down the runway, and returned and went this way, and the faster got, the louder it became, and finally it was airborne. And the airplane took off in the air with my name on it, and I damn near had a mental orgasm. I say, would you look at this? That made me the elite graffiti artist of the world, where nobody would ever repeat what I did, writing a name on a jet or writing a name on an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
The jet gets to California. When it gets to California, it makes the local news for the graffiti artist spray paint TWA jet. Back then, they were making a lot of black exploitative movies. Cotton Comes to Harlem, Sweet Sweet Back, you know all the black movies they was making.
Right,
Yeah, a lot of black exploitative movies. And when the Hollywood Hotshots read the article about Cornbread spray painting a check, they decided to make Cornbread the next project.
Mm-hmm.
And that was approached by American International Release movie producers.
Mm-hmm.
Some years later, they wanted to know who Cornbread was, and he found out that he was a graffiti fanatic from Philadelphia who would write his name on everything. Elephants, the jets, subway tunnels, everywhere. He just demolished Philadelphia. And he wanted to come in and do a movie about me.
Mm-hmm.
So I meet these representatives some like 6 months later. And you see, I was with my Bob and I had met Cool Earl, Bad News Jimmy, Dr. Cool, Titty Peace, Neptune. I had established my clique of wall writers. We
mm-hmm.
were a band of vandals that just took advantage of the city of Philadelphia. We were
mm-hmm.
coming from a summer art class, We're
right.
all walking down the street carrying these banners as if we were protesting. And we had our names on these banners and had sticks on them. And people were stopping their cars and, you know, wanting to talk to us and take a picture with us and meet with us and converse with us. And we were holding that traffic, and we just like to stop the action. And
mm-hmm.
I met these guys from American Industrial Beats who walked up to me and said, I need to talk to you now. I've been trying to contact you about 6 months. I said, contact me about what? He said, we're representatives from America International. He said, we had to do a movie about you. And Earl just turned around and said, Brad, I knew it. We just started embracing each other and hugging. Because I was getting too much ink from the media. And back then, they were making so many black exploited movies. I knew that was either going to happen. So Earl turns to them and says, if y'all can make a movie about Cornbread, I want to be in it. And the guy said, who are you? He said, I'm Cool Earl. He said, what's up? He kept that in mind. So they gave me an address to come to where they were putting an office at 1515 Walton Street, Center City.
Mm-hmm.
And we go in there, and they said that. They gave me the whole concept about what the movie Cornbread Earl and Me is going to be about. They sound good to me. So it's only right that I thought I'd come out and hire me some legal counsel. I got myself a lawyer. And I brought the lawyer to the next meeting. And they said, well, who is this guy? I said, this is my lawyer. He said, your lawyer? Well, who told you the lawyer? I said, common sense. He said, well, Cornbread, our lawyer is your lawyer. And our lawyers are the best lawyers that money can buy. There's no need for your lawyer because a lawyer that will protect that team. We're all on the same team. I said, no, your lawyer is your lawyer, and my lawyer is my lawyer, and I'm going to retain my lawyer. So we couldn't come to a conclusion if I kept my lawyer and used their lawyer or, you know, what was going to do. So they said, well, why don't you bring your lawyer down here next Tuesday, and we'll all sit down and negotiate your contract. I said, sounds good. So the lawyer said, you know, we was walking out the building. He said, man, it's not the way it's going to sound like. I said, why? He said, of course, it's not the way it works. I said, well, I guess we'll find them next Tuesday. Came out in the next Tuesday. He wasn't there. Never heard from him again. Following Tuesday, or the next month, or the next 2 months. Never heard from them again. 5 years later, I'm coming from the store for my father. I'm carrying some grocery bags. My next-door neighbor, who sits in front of their door, she says to me, baby, how come you didn't tell me you was going to be in the movies? She said that my heart started racing because she had no knowledge of me ever being in the movies or being talking with somebody about the movies. I said, why'd you say that? She said, look at this. And she showed me the newspaper article. I mean, the newspaper article. She showed me the newspaper with the movie section with the movie Cornbread Earl and Me. I said, what? So I called Earl. I said, Earl. He got it, man. I was a chair. She was hype. He said, what are you talking about? I said, they made the movies about us. He couldn't make the movies about us. I didn't shoot the movies, Brad. I said, buy yourself a Daily News. He bought the Daily News, and he called me back. He said, man, they got us good, man. Come on, let's go check the movie out. We went down there, and they changed the whole, changed everything. They changed the location from Philadelphia to Southside Chicago. They changed the plot from graffiti to basketball. They changed the characters from me and Earl to Larry Fishburne to other actors that they're using, Cornbread Earl and Me. They changed everything. And the only thing they kept was my name and Earl's name with the title of the movie.
Wow. Well, let me ask you this really quickly. Before you signed the contract, were you talking back and forth about you being acting in the movie, or they were negotiating getting actors to act as you in the movie?
No, we weren't being in the movies. A lot of it was already pre-written. We was going to ad-lib it. A lot of it we were going to speak on our own, and they was going to take out what they wanted and keep what they was going to use. And it was already pre-planned, pre-script.
Wow.
And they just wanted to use me, you know, to play the part of this called with the graffiti artist, but they changed everything to basketball. I would hear it drive me blind. What that did was, all that did was enhance my legacy, because that carried on. It took me from 1965 when I was first sent to youth development in 1965, and what I did to the institution, what I did to Philadelphia, it took me 10 years to go from institution to Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And the legacy just kept growing and growing and growing and growing. I remember walking downtown coming from the movies one night, and I looked up and I see this skyscraper under construction. And I never went anywhere for a skyscraper. And I looked at the tall skyscraper that was surrounded by a fence. So I walked down to the fence with came over the fence onto the construction site, and I caught the elevator shaft that takes material to the top floor, and I rode to the 44th floor.
Mm-hmm.
I got to the top of the skyscraper on this massive slab of concrete. I spray painted Cornbread, King of the Walls. I wrote my name on the elevator, concrete, the steel beams, the steps. I wrote my name on the 44th floor, the 43rd floor, the 42nd floor. I wrote my name. I really did a job in this building under construction. And when the workers and architects came to work the next day, they were hysterical. This guy's really crazy.
Mm.
That lazy, it's like everything I did, the snowball going downhill only got bigger and bigger. I remember I wanted to be the first person ever to spray paint my name on police vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that the chance of me getting caught was great, especially if I wanted to talk to the police station to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I could employ to have the police come to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the Raymond Rosen Projects, and I called the cops, and I told the cops that the gang is beating the crap out of this guy. If you don't get in soon enough, you're going to have a homicide on your hands. And two cop cars shows up. And I tell my man, Kelly, I gave Kelly $20. I said, Kelly, here's $20. Here's a blank gun. And here's some blank cartridges. I'm going to call these cops. And when the cops come, I want to start shooting the blanks at them. He said, but you must be at your mind. Why should I do that? They're going to come in the building looking for the shooter. When they come in the building looking for the shooter, they're going to meet their vehicles unattended. And when they meet their vehicles unattended, I'm going to write my name on them. He said, do it, Bray, do it. So I get downstairs, I call the cops, two cop cars shows up. That wasn't enough. I wanted a whole bunch of cop cars. So Kelly started busting loose at the cops. And they couldn't understand, are we being shot at? And he reloaded and started shooting at them again. And they, like, going back in the car, back up. Before you know it, a whole bunch of cops start coming, and Kelly started shooting at them. And they, like, barricaded the building off of Mike to go in. Nobody came out. They had the K-9 unit, and they had the riot squad. They didn't know what was going on. And they came into the building, rushing the building, found out where the shot was at, on the 10th floor. I told Kelly, who was in the vacant apartment, you see him coming in, drop the gun on the incinerator, and went up to the 9th floor and go into your apartment and chill out. And when he came into the building, he dropped the gun on the incinerator and went downstairs. And left all the vehicles unattended. I must have pulled my name about eight cop cars and paddy wagons. And there was too many cars to take off the street. So the cops are running round and off fully with the word police, Cornbread. But there was nothing they could do about that because they didn't see me do it. It was not against the law. That legacy just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And it eventually migrated the movement because everybody just got involved. Everybody got involved. During that time, the teenagers in Philadelphia underwent a unique experience unlike any other city in America. We're talking about close to 150,000 teenagers involved themselves in a social uprise. They were social clubs who adopted college fraternity names to identify themselves. That was the first wave of the hip-hop revolution. We had parties, dance contests. The difference between us and the young kids today, we dressed up. Now, the young kids today dressed down. Before Atlantic City became the gambling capital of the East Coast, there was nothing but Atlanta, whole bunch of old hotels and motels that which we convened in Atlanta City and had parties that started at 12 midnight that last to 7, 6, 7, 7 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
We had prizes for the best dress, cash prizes for the best dance. That was the first wave of the hip-hop revolution. That movement migrated to New York. The graffiti movement migrated to New York. And then in comes disco. But when it got to the Bronx put a title on it and called it hip-hop. But it was nothing no more than what we would do when we started here in Philadelphia. The graffiti movement started in Philadelphia, and the hip-hop revolution started here in Philadelphia. It wasn't the Bronx, it was New York. It was Philadelphia.
Wow. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. And if anybody's out there listening and want to call in and ask our guests any questions, the call-in number is 646-652-2877, and we'll be back.
Hi, I'm Gail Delicious Johnson. I'm more than just a radio personality. I'm also a best-selling author of 5 published books, publisher, ghostwriter, poet, and a speaker. My latest book, a fast-paced, action-packed, drama-filled novel titled Back to Zero, is available. You can order your autographed copy of Back to Zero and any of my other books from my website. That's www.jjpublishing.com. If you're looking to have your dreams come true in a book, look no further. I am the founder and owner of my own independent publishing company, JJ Publishing. JJ Publishing offers the service to fit the new or seasoned author's budget. There are no hidden fees. I display a professional business attitude towards my clients while treating them with dignity and respect. My mission is to make the first-time author as well as the seasoned author's use of JJ Publishing service a most beneficial and memorable experience. Back to Zero is selling out fast. Don't be left out. Go to my website. Again, that address is www.jjpublishing.com. After you make your purchases, check out my website. I thank you all in advance.
Yeah. hard to do.
That's Gladys Knight and the Pips, Giving Up. I love that song. Y'all know I'm from the old school, but anyway, we're back with our special guest this evening, Darryl McCray, also Cornbread, a legend, graffiti artist legend from Philadelphia, started back in 1967, and now we're talking about hip-hop incorporated into with the graffiti. So, let's see, what do I want to know? So you said eventually it migrated from Philadelphia to New York because, you know, I thought I had heard at one point that graffiti had started in New York, but you're saying that it had.
That is so untrue. In 1965, when I first started in the halls of the juvenile institution, the word graffiti was not even used that much. And that Bronx was not into graffiti. By the time that 1967, 68, 69, City of New York was, it was in the trenches of a heroin epidemic. Graffiti was not a thing. It was a heroin epidemic. I was so big, the American Gangster was the name of the guy who went to Vietnam and purchased off the dope and brought it back.
Frank Lucas, yes.
That's what New York was
on. Mm-hmm.
That's what New York was at that time. I was the only graffiti artist who wrote his name on the wall solely for the purpose of establishing a reputation. By the time it got to New York, it was like it made its passage. It started here and went to New York. And from New York, it went to the four corners of the planet. Now, the graffiti artist was not incorporated into hip-hop in the beginning because the graffiti artist was destructive. He never got his just due. I mean, like, a lot of guys had no respect for the culture. They wrote their name on churches. They were looking at churches, cars, homes. They really destructed a lot of people's personal property. So the graffiti artist never got his recognition. That's why he was recognized. It wasn't until years later that they had to recognize him because that was the first element. The first element of hip-hop is the graffiti artist.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 10 years later when it evolved from writing on walls to bombing to pieces to murals. The graffiti in New York, when you seen the name on the train, you didn't see the train. You seen the person's name and the beautiful art that he did.
Mm-hmm.
That was something beautiful, and that was a plus to the city. But it was also destructive.
So what is the difference in when they did the artwork opposed to you just writing your name? Is there a difference? Does that cause something different? Or, you know, because I see some that's, you know, it's very artful, very tasteful, you know, on the trains and, you know, on walls.
That's,
we have a little graffiti here, but...
That was graffiti art. There's a difference between the writer and the artist. I was a writer, but because the things I did, I was considered the artist because I gave birth to the graffiti culture. I'm the father of the modern day graffiti culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have real God-given individuals who have the creativity, artistic ability to enhance what they're doing, and it just evolved from writing on walls, from vandalism to graffiti art. But, you know, I never went to nobody's house, never went to nobody's church, never went to nobody's car. You know, get up to my cornbread. That was not my forte.
Right. Wow. That's really, you know, so you're the legend. Now,
yeah, I'm the first element. I am very much the first element. The movies, when you talk about the movies, you know, I went to California and I tried to sue the production company,
mm-hmm.
and I got to California. I couldn't prove who I was because I was like, you know, real young, and
mm-hmm.
I didn't have any official documents to prove I didn't have any patent, it wasn't registered, anything of that nature, and
right.
I didn't have any grounds or stuff, no one, and you know, I didn't want to make my trip to Los Angeles in vain. So when I got there, it was like I came up for nothing. So I said, I don't have to get in showbiz. He asked, can you act? I said, yeah, I can act. He said, whom have you worked for? Well, I really didn't know how to act. I just told him, like, I thought I could act. I said, no,
right.
He said, do you have a resume? I said, no. Have you ever worked on a stage before and held audience attention?
Mm-hmm.
I said, no. He said, we don't hire people on the street like that, Cornbread. My suggestion to you is to get some training, you know, go to New York and learn the basic fundamentals of performing arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what I did. I went to New York, and I studied performing arts for 5 years. I went to James Franco, Henry Sue Settlement. I went to Barbara Antier. The only guarantee I got was no guarantee. I stayed in New York for 5 years
mm-hmm.
trying to be an actor. And it takes normally about 7 years to determine if you're going to be there or not. And
mm-hmm.
normally people fall within those 7 years. I left for 5 years. Only guarantee
mm-hmm.
I got was no guarantee. And, you know, I came back to Philadelphia. When I got back to Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia looked like another world. Graffiti was everywhere.
Mm.
You know, I had caused a psychological effect on the minds of the teenage generation of Philadelphia, and they were trying to receive the same neurality that I had established, but it never happened. Like I said,
mm-hmm.
the media had created a monster, and everybody was trying to get that same, you know, notoriety that I had got. And Wilson Good was running for office as a mayor. And his top priority was to rid the city of Philadelphia of the graffiti that turned away city business.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to him and I said, Your Honor, I could be an asset to your program, which he had established the Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network. And I told him, I could be an asset to your program if you gave me a job. And he looked at me like, well, who might you be? And I had
mm-hmm.
my scrapbook with him. And I said, this is who I am. And he said, Cornbread. Oh, you got the job. You got the job. I want you working with me. I want you to be out here Tuesday for the press conference so I can let everybody know who's working with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out with all these writers, all these newspaper writers, all these magazines and different newspapers was taking pictures of me and, you know, writing different articles about me. And I said, wow, it's like this after all these years.
Turns you to an instant celebrity, huh?
Yeah, I didn't know. I thought that where I was going, that it would have died out, but it had. But what it did, it got bigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of graffiti writers who were to face the city came in and followed me and helped me with Wilson Good clean the city up. And today, Philadelphia is graffiti free.
Wow!
And that movement, it thrived. It moved on to New York and. When it got to the Bronx called it hip-hop. They did exactly the same thing we did. They just put a title to it. But it all started here in Philadelphia.
So Philadelphia
yeah.
is graffiti-free now.
Yes.
Was that a movement that you started, or how did that come about?
That's a movement I gave birth to.
Oh, okay. Wow. So it was an organization that went around and cleaned up the graffiti.
Oh, no. That's a Wilson. I was a program that Wilson Good started. Mm-hmm. Because the city looked so bad. It was like, it really looked bad. It was terrible. It really looked bad. It looked like another planet. You know, mm-hmm. and the graffiti was everywhere. And its top priority, more so than anything else, was to clean the city up. So when he hired me, I hired some more graffiti artists to work under me. And he said, I said, Cornbread, I want you to clean your neighborhood. I said, when he said, no, you come from North Philly, you're in charge of the entire North Philly. I was a Phil representative. It was directed by Tim Spencer. And we did a hell of a job cleaning the city up. A lot of guys got involved, you know, cleaning the city up. And today, it is the mural capital of the world. He hired Jane Golden. She was the representative for the murals department. Kids came in who wanted to know how to do murals, work under mm-hmm. her leadership. Mm-hmm. And when the funding for the mural arts stopped, you know, was a good enough office, she took that project and moved on to someplace else. Mm-hmm. And that mural arts program is still in existence. It's one of the biggest entities in this country.
Hmm.
I have a very close relationship with the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program still to today.
Hmm. Well, let me ask my co-hosts if they have any questions. Do you guys have any questions that you'd like to ask Cornbread?
No, I just want to say I used to dabble in graffiti too. Once I got older and got off the street, I was like too late to be running. So I stopped putting it on shirts and clothes and shoes and everything else. So I just want to ask him, like, for him, was doing it like therapeutic, or did he use that to like release whatever he had inside him?
Did I what? Was it some type of therapeutic?
You know, like when you was putting your, well, I don't know if you was doing throw, you was doing tag, you was writing. But I'm saying once you was doing it in the places you were doing them, it was, for me, art is like releasing my spirit or whatever I have going on inside of me onto canvas or whatever I put it on. So when I used to do them on the walls, too, it was like more like a not a gang thing, but you know how it is, you know, your side over here, our side over here, we used to do the little wall tags or whatever. So
right,
to me,
well, my mother died in 1969, and I used that to mask the pain. You know, even with the book that I'm writing, I can't describe my mother's death. You know, my grandmother raised me. My mother went to school and she worked. And we were a very close-knit family. My grandmother died in 1967 and my mother died in 1969. And it's like my world just came to an end. I mean, that was the beginning of my end. And I basically raised myself in the street. And a lot of times, you know, to mask the pain of my mother and grandmother's death, you know, I would sit there and just wobble with my misery and cry and didn't know what to do with myself. And I would get my spray paint. And I'd go out and I would walk, I would write, and I would cry. You know, but the pain wasn't so much because my mom was on something else.
Hmm.
That was therapeutic for me in a sense. I also use it as a ploy to escape the pressures of the ghetto life. A lot of my friends went to drugs, gangs, and killings.
Right, right.
You know, and a lot of crime, you know. So they carried me a long way, you know, and I use it as an avenue to take me where I wanted to go and keep me out of jail in some of the, you know, so many ways.
Okay.
But the guiding force behind you tagging initially was because you wanted to see your name, right?
Yes, I was definitely a glutton for publicity. I was an attention seeker, and I had a newspaper columnist in my back pocket. I would tell him what I'm going to write on, and when I would, he said, "Well, call me back when it's night." And he would be the first person to write about what I did. And the other newspapers had to come to him for the article to follow up a suit. And then with Tom Fox, man, Tom Fox was pretty tight. You know, he wrote things about me, and, you know, he put in their contacts and he sold newspapers, and I was his ploy. He would be the first newspaper writer to cover the story. I remember once coming into Philadelphia off of 95. When you reach the city limits, there would be a sign that said, Philadelphia. I wrote on the sign, "Welcome to Cornbread." It was just, I extended the welcome myself to people that came into Philadelphia. And having said that, there was a family that migrated from the South that came into Philly. And there's a guy named Raphael Parrish. He came in and seen the sign, "Welcome to Philadelphia Cornbread." And it was like a church family. And Raphael played in the church band. So when he came into the city, you know, he seen "Welcome to Philadelphia." And he asked his mom, "Why do it say, 'Welcome to Philadelphia Cornbread, Mama?'" He said, "Oh, Cornbread is a guy who goes around writing his name all over the city." But when he came into the city, he was befuddled. He seen Cornbread's name everywhere. He said, "Well, why is everybody writing Cornbread's name?" He says, "Not everybody's writing. There's one guy who's writing Cornbread everywhere." He said, "Wow, that's really amazing." And then the church boy coming to the big city and seeing his name Cornbread everywhere, he was struck. So he was like really messed up in the mind. He was affected mentally. Everywhere he went, he seen Cornbread. So when, as he got older, he wanted to be a graffiti artist and be Cornbread. He eventually became a graffiti artist. But by this time, by the time he got older, I had moved on. So he met this girl who lived next door to him, and he always talked about Cornbread. So I got a job as a bus driver carrying kids, picking kids up from school, from their home, taking them to school, and taking them from school back to their home. So I befriend one of my passengers, their mother, and I was telling her about who I was. And I had my scrapbook, and I showed my scrapbook. She was like, "You know, I have a friend who always talks about you named Raphael, and he talks about you like he's got to be your biggest fan, and he really would love to meet you. Would it be all right if I gave him your phone number?" I said, "Sure." So I gave him my phone number, and she gave him my phone number. And Raphael called me. He said, "Is this Cornbread?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "My name is Raphael, but I don't believe you're the real Cornbread." I said, "That might be me. That is me." He said, "Wow." So he was no longer a church band member. He became an R&B band member, and he was a graffiti artist. He said, "Man, I would really like to meet you, man. If you could come to my studio, we can talk." I go to a studio. He said, "Would you mind if I wrote a song about you?" I said, "Yes, you can write a song about me." So he clicked on the recording. He said, "I want you to tell me about yourself, how you started." You know, of course, I remember reading your name when I was small, when I came to Philadelphia, and I said, read the sign, "Welcome to Philadelphia." And I've been messing about saying name all over the city all my life. And just tell me a story about how you first started. So I start telling him a story about how I first started, like I'm telling you now. And he recorded everything I said, and he wrote a song. The song is the song that's the theme song to my documentary. I don't know, Gail, if you listened to the documentary, when the documentary ended, the theme song came on.
So I heard it, but I can't really recall it right now. I have to play it again to see it.
It's really, really nice. It's really, really nice. And, you know, real popular R&B singer. He sings at an Italian club up in Northeast, like Tuna, Philadelphia. It's basically an all-white audience, and they love him. I also have a song about me, that's it, that 50 Cent did about me, because I know Beanie Siegel's family personally, and when Beanie Siegel was doing his thing, I knew his mother, I knew his father.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, you remind me of Daryl. And he was like, who is Daryl? Daryl is Cornbread. He was the beginning of all this hip stuff that our kids are doing. And he started this when he was young. And they called him Cornbread. He wrote his name everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the more he grew up, the more he heard about me and started checking me out. So when 50 Cent came to do a show at one of the entertainment centers, he told 50 Cent, whatever you do, give Cornbread a shout-out. And 50 Cent came and got me a shout-out. I didn't know it. In fact, I didn't know who 50 Cent was.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I was home, all the young kids in the corner just started running to me, where you know 50 Cent from? Where you know 50 Cent from? I said, who was 50 Cent? You don't know who 50 Cent? He was one of the biggest rappers. And when I got to listen to the song, he was really giving me some props. He was giving me some props. I got several songs. In fact, the song that you got that you say your friend is on with us, I want a copy of that. How about that?
Oh, okay, I'll send you the. I'm going to send you the whole show.
Yeah. So this legacy is goes on and on and on. And 2015, I'll be inducted to the Smithsonian. They were looking for people who made a difference in the world.
Mm-hmm.
My name came up, and I got a call, and they said, we would like to come and talk with you and interview you to see if you're eligible for entry into the Smithsonian. Do you have anything that we can check out and take with us? I said, sure. He came to my house a couple times, and I have all type of paintings, murals, newspaper clippings, and golden, and custom frames, appearances, speeches, colleges that I spoke at. I mean, this thing just goes on and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to my house, he said, wow, because my walls was adored for all my savings, you know, things that I saved. And they, I want this, I want that, I want that, I want this. I said, no, you can't have this. I did an appearance speak at the World Cafe at 30th and Walnut.
Mm-hmm.
Let me add that most of my viewers and most of the people who buy into this culture are white people.
Mm-hmm.
White people. The white people, the college students at Drexel University, you know, they had a big event, and I was a guest speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out, introduced me. I mean, all the students just went off. They was like, you know, give me accolades and praising and making a type of noise and applause with me. And I said, wow, this is really nice. So they had this sheet over top of this, over this canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And I came out, I said my speech. One of the guys gave me a can of spray paint. He said, we want you to write your name. I said, write my name where? And he pulled this sheet down off of this canvas. And on this canvas was a big picture of me. I said, wow. So I wrote my name on the canvas, and everybody just went off. Everybody just went off. He said, this is yours, man. And I took the canvas home. I couldn't put it on my wall because I had more room, so I put it in my back room. So when representatives from the Smithsonian came to my house, I showed them the canvas, the picture, and they said, we want that. I said, no, you can't have that. And they said, Cornbread, this is going to be here 50 years after you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are part of America's history. We want that, we want that, we want that, we want that, and we want that. And if you want us to put your image in American history, give it to us. and I gave it up to him. I'll be inducted to the Smithsonian 2015 when the new building will be erected, which will probably be in June, July sometime.
So there's going to be a big ceremony as far as that's concerned. So where is this going to be? Is this going to be in Philadelphia or somewhere else?
It's going to be Washington, D.C.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Wow.
I've also made contact with an equity firm, who is now in the process of branding my name with Universal Sales. Mm-hmm. If you visit my website, cornbreadthedungeon.com, we're selling T-shirts, hoodies, caps. This website will be shown on 5 different continents and 5 different languages.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just the beginning.
Wow.
I can be reached at cornbread1philly@gmail.com. My website is cornbreadthelegend.com. Feel free to contact me, chat with me, and buy my merchandise.
Okay. Wow, that, you know, it's rare that, you know, you can actually meet a living legend, you know, regardless to what his profession is. But it's also exciting because, you know, you have something that you're going to leave, a legacy. So this was a great treat. It was really a great treat, too.
I also want to add that my documentary, Cry the City, was put together very well by Sean McKnight. He's a filmmaker. Sean did an excellent job.
Mm-hmm.
But I was impressed. I was highly impressed when I seen the documentary that was made. I don't know who the artist was, who the filmmaker was, but it was a documentary about the Crips and the Blood. The Crips and the Blood. That documentary was so authentic, was so real, was so well put together.
Mm-hmm. I think I
see
that.
I'm now dealing with a professor from the University of Maryland,
mm-hmm.
who has a graduate student whose major is in film, and she's
mm-hmm.
looking for some real serious work to do. And the professor was here at my house about a month ago, and he shot me from 11 o'clock in the morning to about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
They were edited, and they are currently working on a project about a documentary regarding the violence in the black neighborhood, incarceration, and drugs.
Oh,
and that project is complete. Then they're going to restart the project and do my documentary over again. And he said it's going to be on the same level as the Crips and the Blood. You got to check out that documentary about the Crips and the Blood. That was very well put together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to where I'm in a conversation now, the works about the movie about my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to write it myself. I don't want nobody else to write it, because if somebody else write it, they own it. I want to write it myself along with a co-writer.
Mm-hmm.
So the documentary, a motion film,
mm-hmm.
the Smithsonian, and the equity firm, it's just about ready to happen. I just hope that I live it long enough to reap the rewards. I started when I was 11. Today I am
mm-hmm.
60, and it's not going to stop until I drop.
Wow. Well, you've definitely come a long way. We're going to take a little break and come back, and we'll begin to come to the end of the show, okay?
Okay.
Listen up. I got to tell you about this beautiful author and publisher, Gail Delicious Johnson. Gail Delicious Johnson is proud to announce the publication of her new revised issue of her latest suspenseful novel, Back to Zero. Read this riveting story of intrigue, conflict, love, and suspense. Follow the trail of abuse, secrets, lies, and love. And check it out. You can't just read the back of the book, because you have to prepare yourself for the mind-blowing, explosive ending. Order your personally autographed copy of Back to Zero by visiting www.jjpublishing.com. That's www.jayjaypublishing.com.
Now wait a minute, Shirley. I'm a young woman, and I can't afford to do all the things you do for this man. I don't even have a job, and I can't buy his clothes, pay his condo, and I surely can't keep money in his pocket. But I can give him what he needs when he needs it, and that's all he expects from me. I can give him love.
Alrighty, that was Barbara Mason, From His Woman to Woman. Okay. Anyway, we're back with Daryl Cornbread McCray. And this has been a wonderful conversation that we had here this evening on Bringing Sexy Back. Daryl, do you have any last closing remarks that you'd like to leave us with?
Yes. I am currently involved with a body of graffiti artists of Philadelphia by the name of Graph X graffiti artists who have band together to give back to the community that they once destructive to. We work with the senior citizens, we work with children, we work with the homeless. We do what we can do, as much as we can do. to graduating students. We give out hats, scarves, and gloves to children in elementary schools. We have food drives for the needy people, individuals, homeless people. We give out dinners to the senior citizens. We do as much as we can from the bottom of our hearts, giving mm-hmm. back to the community.
Wow, that's wonderful. That is just fantastic. You want to give out your website again and your email address so that the listeners are, you know, can get in touch with
my
you.
My website is cornbreadtheveteran.com. You can reach me personally on my email. My email address is cornbread Philly. It's cornbread one Philly. Again, cornbread one Philly at gmail.com.
Okay. I'm going to ask my co-host, do you have any closing remarks, anything you'd like to say to Cornbread before we end the show? Anybody?
It was very interesting. We want to thank you for coming on and joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'll come again.
We're going to give you a great big round of applause.
That was a great applause. I appreciate
right.
that.
Right. And we, you know, we do appreciate you for coming out this evening. And, Rhea, you want to let everybody know where you're at?
Well, the easiest way to the easiest way to get in contact with me is on Facebook. But I am RhiaAlexis@yahoo.com. I'm on Facebook as RhiaAlexisMBanks. But you can also reach me through Amazon, Goodreads, Safari, and Barnes & Noble's website.
Wow.
All righty then. Okay, Jadino.
Yeah, you can reach me on Facebook as well, but mostly I'm everywhere. my email address is jdinoblasko@gmail.com. That's jdinoblasko@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, I must say I really enjoyed your show.
Okay. Let's let Jade let everybody know where she's at. This is my last co-host. Jade.
Oh, y'all can find me on Erotic Talk Radio on Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern with my co-host, Mr. Licious, that hangs out with me on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern. And y'all can check me. Y'all can inbox me at jade@eroticexpression.net.
All right.
Okay. You know, Bring Your Sexy Back is for the mature listening audience, and our subject matter is sexual, but not limited to other social topics. We discuss relationships, current events, and issues relevant to everyday life. We appreciate you, our listening audience, for your questions and comments. If you have a topic you'd like for us to discuss or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to me. That's gjdelicious37@gmail.com. Or to either of my co-hosts, that's Rhea@RhiaAlexis@yahoo.com, RhiaAlexis@yahoo.com, and to jdinoblasko@gmail.com. And in the subject line, you can type topic or guest. We're here every Wednesday from 10:30 p.m. for an hour or so, sometimes 2 hours for adult conversations. And as you guys already know, my other shows are down for the season. We'll be back in September or something like that. But I do appreciate you, Rhea, Jade, and Jadino for, you know, hanging in there with me tonight. And, you know, hope you guys have a beautiful rest of the weekend. And, you know, I'll see you guys back here next Wednesday, same place, same time. So everybody take care. Thank you guys for out there listening. You know, you could have been doing anything else, but you was right here with me and my guests and my co-hosts, and hope you enjoyed the show. Everybody, with that being said, good night. Love you guys.
And I'm hoping, wishing you all a great weekend, and to the mothers, happy Mother's Day.
Same
Mother's
to
y'all. Happy Mother's
Thank
Day to
you.
All you ladies out there.
Thank you. Same to you, Rhea and Jade. Y'all have a beautiful rest of the weekend. See you guys next week.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
My mother got the best radio show on the internet.
Nah, I can hang up because I heard the baby.